On Debt, Sex, and Money, we feature interviews with you, our community of listeners, getting honest about uncomfortable things.
I developed an illness where it isn't safe for me to drive. A friend once said to me, sex is like air. You don't think about it until you're not getting enough. This is a similar sort of thing if you just replace sex with driving.
Listen to Debt, Sex, and Money wherever you get podcasts.
Hello, listener. Dahlia Lithwick here, host of Amicus, that's Slate's podcast on the courts and the law and democracy and the rule of law. This May, our team will be publishing a special project that we are calling How Originalism Ate the Law. This neutral and academic-sounding methodology of looking at the law is, in fact, anything but neutral. Originalism is to the conservative legal movement what peanut butter is to jelly. As we're going to show you over the course of this project, originalism has been both cover and calling for conservative justices and judges to radically overhaul the lives of millions of Americans. And while they claim to be the apolitical interpreters of the Constitution and its author's intents, they have overturned Roe, radically expanded gun rights, and eviscerated voting rights. Across Slate.com and the Amicus podcast, we're going to be tackling questions like, where did originalism come from? Why has it taken over? Are progressive originalists really a thing? And am I allowed to have an opinion on originalism? Spoiler, the answer to that last question, you are. To celebrate the launch of this big project, we are running a special 2-week-long free trial of Slate Plus on Apple Podcasts. As a member, you'll get exclusive episodes from How Originalism Ate the Law, plus ad-free listening to all of your favorite Slate podcasts. Join now by clicking Try Free at the top of the Amicus show page or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen.
I called up Gulchetra Hoxha because I wanted her to translate this moment for me. If you're watching the Olympics, you might remember it. It was during the opening ceremonies.
And welcome back to this opening ceremony from Beijing, China.
As dancers whizzed around them, two athletes appeared with the Olympic flame, officially opening the games. They were all smiles as they placed a tiny torch in the center of a giant matrix of snowflakes. Then fireworks erupted. But the identity of one of these athletes, a downhill skier from the Xinjiang province, alarmed some viewers. Because this skier, she's Uyghur, a member of a minority group that the U.S. says the Chinese government is trying to systematically eliminate. Are you watching the Olympics?
No, not at all. Even my kids reject it.
Gulchetra, her friends call her Gul, is Uyghur too.
This Olympic is about our dignity, you know, so we reject to watch it.
Gul heard about this moment, of course. Its trollishness seemed to strike her as almost funny.
It's a very natural reaction. We all see that as a Chinese government using this girl to cover up the Uyghur genocide.
Do you worry that some people might see that and think it was a message of unity, like everything's okay?
I don't think the world is that naive, no. I don't think anybody who knows the China, who knows the situation in Uyghur region, they will never, you know, see that way, I think.
Today on the show, if you know much of anything about the situation in the Uyghur region, it's because of the journalism of people like Gul. She left her hometown 20 years ago, and the reporting she's done in the years since means she may never be able to go back. I'm Mary Harris. You're listening to What Next? Stick around.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity, much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at Progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
The Chinese name for the region where Gul grew up is Xinjiang, or New Frontier. But for Uyghurs, like Gul, this frontier is not new at all. It's their homeland. And Gul says, growing up, she had this sense of Uyghur pride. That was partially because of her family, but also because of when she was growing up, in the late 80s and the early 90s. Back then, the Uyghur region, which Gul calls East Turkestan, was in transition. The Chinese Communist Party, or CCP, was incentivizing Han Chinese to move here, but they weren't violently forcing Uyghurs to assimilate the way they are now.
I think we are the lucky generation who born after, you know, 70s, 80s, the relaxed couple of decades. We can use our own language to study in the school, and we can read some Uyghur books, you know. We don't have religious freedom over there, but still we can see our elderly grandpa, grandmas can pray. We can learn our own tradition, lifestyle. That's the totally different, from now.
It sounds like a window of freedom.
Yeah, little bit. We can compare to now, we can call it little have freedom, of course. That's why we have that proud to be Uyghur, that feelings, very strong feelings.
I understand that you grew up just down the street from the regional museum where your dad worked as an archaeologist and your grandfather was a Uyghur musician. Can you explain the Uyghur culture and what are some of the core elements of it for someone like me who's not able to go there?
I am very lucky to grown up such a rich culture family. My father was working in Xinjiang Museum, and every day I went to museum because our home was behind the museum. The whole museum was like in my memory, like my playground.
What was your favorite exhibit?
The Silk Road. I imagine myself in the middle of the desert, you know, a princess, you know, and I love our clothes, very beautiful. Everybody have long hair, Uyghur women, so pretty. And our food, you know, most delicious food in the world, I think. Maybe any culture, they feel their food is the best, but really, really, Uyghur food is very delicious.
So eventually, you grew up, you went to university, you decided to go into broadcasting. Why did you want to do that? Like, why did you want to be on TV?
I studied in normal university, Uyghur language and literature. And when we practice in the last year for before the graduation, we practice in the schools, become a teacher, of course. And I feel like I should have more kids to teach. I feel I really want to share all my knowledge with Uyghur kids, let them know who they are beyond the books.
I read that in your first television appearance, you wore a floral hat and your hair in two ponytails. It was like this iconic Uyghur image.
Yes, I want to the followers who's watching my TV wants them to be look like Uyghur, speak like Uyghur, think like Uyghur. That's why I was preparing myself, even my look, my language, all. And that's why my program was so loved by not only children, teachers, even the grandparents, parents, all loves that show.
Was that a big deal for you to go on TV and present as just like completely Uyghur?
Yeah, because we feel the pressure that time. We feel more Han Chinese people coming, and also the policy toward Uyghurs are more, you know, have assimilation and the propaganda. So that time we were fighting for keep our identity. Of course, sometimes I get trouble and warnings as well.
Gul became a household name after appearing on Xinjiang TV, hosting the first children's program in the region. She was a presenter on Chinese state media. She was even in commercials and music videos. This video is set in the mountains of Central Asia. And the song, Gul says, is about love and appreciation for one's homeland. It's one of only a few remnants of her work in China before she got erased for speaking out. You've described a trip you took to Europe in 2001 as a turning point for you, a moment where you literally never went back, which it's so dramatic. In some ways, it's almost unbelievable that you would leave China and then have this realization and just never go back. How did it even happen?
When I come to Europe, I have freedom to see all the internet, you know, what's happening outside of Uyghur region, what is the Uyghur movement look like, you know, what kind of contribution they doing, the outside Uyghurs. So I watch all. In Europe, I had the chance to listening Radio Free Asia, and I listen whole year program.
Really?
Yes, whole year's program. It's like a half an hour show that time, every day. You know, it's totally different from what we are producing to people, of course. And I feel guilty. I feel shame. You know, I was so proud to be a TV host, to be a journalist, to be a famous in the Uyghur region. But that shows what I'm doing is just like a propaganda, not enough, you know, not enough for proud to be, you know, broadcast or a journalist. It's no freedom over there. And I feel there's nothing to proud of. So what should I do? What's my parents' wish? I think very deep and I change my mind that time. I feel like I cannot go back and continue what I was doing. And I was thinking, what you can see freely, think freely, speak freely, that's called happiness. That's called freedom. That's why I choose that, you know, and I make decision.
The decision Gul made was to show up at the offices of Radio Free Asia and ask for a job. It was a gutsy move. RFA is funded by the U.S. government. The Chinese consider its work propaganda. But RFA welcomed her. She was a familiar face to some of the staffers, a bit of a celebrity. Some colleagues were giddy to have such a high-profile defector from the Chinese Communist Party.
They were so proud. Even a director of RFA, he was saying, oh, we win, CCP. We got you, you know. Immediately, the next day I start. I was like giving my 100% energy to the work. And I didn't pay attention what Chinese government doing.
When did you know you wouldn't be able to go back?
After first call to my father. Yeah, my parents. After 2 weeks, I called them. after I came to US, I chose to come to US and work for RFA. I couldn't tell them, because if I tell, I am the only daughter, you know, in the family. Of course, they don't want me to just disappear like that. They will not bear that, you know, separation. That's my first ever decision without my father's guide. And I don't regret it. I don't regret it. If I have and had 100 times, you know, have to have the decision, I will choose the same. Because freedom is everything. After I came, Chinese government seized my all videos, movies, commercials, everything, and put me in some kind of red notes.
A red notice.
Yeah. Accusing me as separatist in that time, in 2001.
This red notice meant Gul was technically a fugitive. Her parents were forced into early retirement because of her work.
Only one word my father was saying, "Oh, my brave girl, Nozgul." Nozgul, she was a very heroic woman in Uyghur history who stood up for the Chinese regime and died. So he giving me that name, I feel he is proud of my decision. Even it's so hard and so painful for him. But my mother says, please be careful what you're speaking, you know, what you're saying. And we miss you, we're proud of you. And live happily, live proudly, she says.
When was the last time you spoke to her?
1.5 months ago, but it has several conditions. After I call first time, she has to hang up and let the neighborhood police know I am calling. Then after 15 minutes, I call them again. That's the condition she has to follow. And I only can ask, you know, how was there and about their health, you know, life. And we cannot talk any other sensitive subject. Even I cannot ask other relatives who's being arrested. She's okay. She's okay. She's a very strong. And actually, she is the most strong human being and the woman I know I ever seen.
More with Gulchandra Hoja after a break. This episode is brought to you by Discover. When it comes to your finances, Discover wants you to know they are the credit card that is always there for you. With 24/7 US-based live customer service, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, that means no more waiting for, quote, normal business hours just to get a hold of someone. We are talking real service from real people whenever you need it. Get the customer service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
If you want to understand what is happening in the United States right now, you really need to understand what's happening with the courts, the law, and the Supreme Court. The battle between democracy and whatever this cage match is that we're witnessing, it's going to be won and lost at the ballot box, but it's also going to be won and lost in the courtrooms. I'm Dahlia Lithwick. I host Slate's legal podcast, Amicus, and we are doubling our output, bringing you weekly episodes from here on in, because how else can we keep an eye on the many trials of Donald Trump, the conservative legal movement's assaults on our rights, the Supreme Court's latest slate of environmental gutting, gun safety eviscerating cases on the docket? So follow Amicus wherever you get your podcasts, new episodes dropping every Saturday morning.
I want to talk about your reporting, if we can, because I think a lot of Americans have an idea of what's happening with the Uyghurs in China, but they may not have the idea that part of the reason they know that is because of the work you've done. So I'm wondering if you can tell the story of how you began reporting on what was happening in your region.
In the 2016, I believe, we find out there's many camps called re-education camps, Chinese government saying. But we heard horrible story from the camp survivors. They describe there is like crime against humanity. And the first, the international media was questioning so much, you know, and couldn't believe. And because of the very low knowledge about where is the Uyghur region, who are the Uyghurs. So we have to give information about all, you know, background and take so much time. And the 2018 major media start to, you know, watching the Uyghur region, what's going on. And then Chinese government couldn't hide well. And they said, first they denying we don't have concentration camp. And second, they were announcing, oh, those are not concentration camps. Those are education, you know, re-education camps. Then they denying that again. They are like training camps for the, you know, for providing job to Uyghurs and other minorities. So they changing their tones. Of course, after we, you know, spoke out, many of the stories comes out. And then the whole world, you know, believing us, what's going on.
Who was the first victim you interviewed where you thought, oh, I know what's happening?
Yeah, Umar Bek Ali was born in Uyghur region, Pichan, and he married and moved to Kazakhstan. Actually, he has dual citizenship, Chinese and Kazakh. He was working in what travel companies between Kazakh and the Uyghur region. When he went to Uyghur region in 2016 and get arrested and questioning, you know, to did you participate any terrorist group, you know, any kind of threat, and he has more than 1 year experience in several camps and tortured. After he get out from the China, because of family members fight for him, he reunite with his family in Kazakhstan.
I was reading the Holocaust Memorial Museum's report about what's happening to the Uyghur people.
Mm-hmm.
And a few things stood out to me. One was something you've been getting out in this conversation, which is this kind of slowly heating up situation where you grew up in a region and were able to have a Uyghur identity, and slowly, slowly it was like a vise tightening, and all of a sudden it seemed like things got much worse, but really groundwork had been laid for a long time. Like, one thing that stood out to me was the fact that the Chinese government, yes, has camps that people have probably heard about, has done really atrocious things, and then also has put in place these incentives for Han Chinese to move to the Uyghur region, and not just move to the Uyghur region, but do things like marry Uyghur women. And your children, if you're in a family that's Han and Uyghur, they may get a preferential slot at university. So all of these ways that incentivize Uyghur culture breakdown that I just hadn't understood the sheer breadth of what was happening.
Some call it genocide with justification, including U.S. government China's crimes, genocide or crimes against humanity. You know, right now, the many, many more countries recognize it. So Chinese government sees us like the enemies because of we are the first news outlet cover the issues in our homeland, what's going on in the Uyghur region. That's why Chinese government target our families back home, trying to silence us. For example, my family member, 24 of them, one night, just in one night, Chinese government sent them to camp in 2018, February.
24 of them in one night?
Yes, in one night.
Do you feel lucky that you left?
I cannot describe that as lucky, you know. Being a human, when your loved ones suffering, you wish, you want to be with them, of course, right? Rather, I want to be with them. Like this burden, like burning outside of this fire, like I feel it's very hard. That's why only release for me is work harder to do something for them. But I feel never enough. You're never enough doing to help them. Physically, I'm here, yeah. But mentally, I am suffering with them together because I cannot say I'm lucky, I'm happy without them.
I read that your kids, you couldn't bring them to visit their grandparents, but your husband was able to.
Only my oldest one. It was in 2008 Olympic time. We picked that time because of we believe that specific time is international media have eye on the Chinese government, you know, China, and spot also Uyghur region. So we strongly believe they cannot do anything, you know, to harm. So I will watch them. I will, you know. So me and my husband was decide maybe we should, you know, try to go there and make grandpa, grandma proud, you know, and see their own grandchildren, smell her, kiss her, have that feeling. So my husband was bravely says, yes, we have to do it. This is the moment, you know, we could try. And we tried, but in 2 weeks, my husband says, immediately, you know, they sending to police to watch him every day. Every morning they call and they write down the plans, what he going to do that day, daily routine. But what we bring to our family is a hope, you know, the love, how much I miss them. So they see my daughter as sees me. That's the happiest moment for them.
You mentioned how the one time your parents have seen one of your children was the last Olympics, and that you've last spoken to your mother 6 weeks ago. So I wonder if you think that this Olympics, are you going to give her a call during this time, thinking maybe this is...
No.
No. Why?
Anything Chinese government established, have some big meeting or some holidays coming, that's the most dangerous moment for Uyghurs. Tension, you know, the Chinese government will spend more to control Uyghurs.
So you're saying now is the most dangerous time?
Yes, most dangerous time. They don't want anybody, you know, giving information about Uyghur region to the outside, the what kind of pressure they're facing. That's why I don't want to put them in more danger. So I decide to not to call. I just pray.
It sounds like your work has come at a tremendous cost.
All Uyghurs, I believe, just like me right now, any Uyghur, and if you ask any Uyghur abroad, they have some family members, even maybe friends, close friends, loved ones, still in concentration camps. Nobody is happy. Nobody. In Uyghurs, we says, is it harder to burn middle of the fire or around the fire? So we were just like that. We all suffer, even we are not in the Uyghur homeland, not in the concentration camps. Mentally, we are suffered.
Gul, I'm just in awe of your work, and I'm really grateful for you joining us.
Thank you so much, and thank you for having me. It's really an honor to talk to you, too. Thank you for giving us the voice, you know, giving us the another platform to speak out.
Gulchetra Hoxha is a Uyghur journalist with Radio Free Asia. At least 24 of her family members have been arrested during the Chinese crackdown on the Uyghur minority. And that's our show. What Next is produced by Carmel Dalshad, Mary Wilson, Elena Schwartz, and Daniel Hewitt. We are led by Alicia Montgomery, and I'm Mary Harris. Stay tuned to this feed. Lizzie O'Leary is going to take the baton for a couple days, and she's going to be here with What Next TBD. You are not going to want to miss it. And I will be back in this feed bright and early on Monday.